think we had a, so this is the title of our workshop, and it was a long workshop, 13 weeks, and I think I would take the opportunity to thank some people. And so the organizers were Tomoka Ota, Eric Davidson, Steve Small, Michael Lessig, and myself. And I think the list of organizers reflects something which we try to achieve here, which was really a true melting of biology and physics. So two of the organizers, Eric Davidson and Steve Small, are wet lab biologists, and they were instrumental in making this possible, that we had many speakers from wet lab biology, and some of them also stayed for quite a long time, which I think was beautiful. So then I also want to thank Boris Schreiman, who helped putting this all together and was helpful in many ways. I also want to thank the staff of the KITP for helping in many ways, and without them this would not have been possible. So then I compiled some statistics. So again, we are in the 13th weeks, and we had altogether roughly 100 talks. We had something like 130 participants. And if you calculate this, it amounts to something like 6 days of day and night continuous talks. And after I compiled this, I was wondering, what have we learned from all this? Can we arrive at some general wisdoms? And I'm afraid I paused for a long time after this, and I'm not sure if I came up with any compiled wisdoms. But what I will try to do is to walk you through the three topics here: molecules in the cell, networks comprised of interactions between the molecules, and then looking at the evolution of all of this. And I'll also just try to give an impression of what is possible nowadays, what can people measure really regarding these quantities, and is it amenable to computational theoretical approaches. And so the key, so I'll start with molecules. And the key molecules are obviously DNA and RNA and proteins. So in each cell of your body, you have in almost all cases the same hereditary information, i.e. you have the same DNA molecules. However, this is not really true. This is only true in a good, very good first approximation. For example, in people who have cancer, the cancer cells have oftentimes changed their genotype, i.e. they have different DNA molecules compared to healthy cells. And then also, as we learned today in a wonderful talk about the immune system, there are also changes in the DNA which generate the vast arsenal of response to infecting agents. And so what is measured here? So 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the human genome sequence was published with great fanfare, and it was a remarkable year because it was also the year of the first long, extensive workshop, KITP workshop about biology and physics, organized mainly by Terry Hua in those days. And if I compare what we know now, 6 years later, what kind of data have come together, and also the sophistication, I must say, of the participants, it was very impressive to me. It was really astounding. And so I participated as a postdoc in those days, and every talk basically started out with some biologist or speaker explaining, okay, so DNA makes RNA, makes protein, and so there were already like 15 minutes maybe devoted to resolving some basic questions about this. Now, during the talks, there were questions also from the young members, which were, to me, astoundingly informed and sophisticated. So this is great, but also in the terms of measurement, so the human genome was published, the sequence, but then of course it was only approximation, many parts were missing, the annotation, i.e. where are the information carrying parts in the DNA, it was all completely, nobody really knew, and there was all kinds of confusion. Nowadays, I think, although there are lots and lots of problems still with the genomic sequence of the human genome, you have a pretty precise measurement of the DNA, and also in many cases know quite well where are the genes, where is the information, and so forth. But I mean, again, this is just a first approximation, but it's still a vast, vast advance of what was around 6 years ago. So this we know to some extent. Then it's also true that not only the DNA, and so it's also true that the DNA between two individuals randomly picked from the human population are different. So you have a difference on average every 300 nucleotides. So the DNA is comprised of four nucleotides, makes one long string of ACGTs, which are grouped into chromosomes. So if you pick two individuals from the street, they will differ every 300 bases, nucleotides, on average. So in the meantime, after this was published, there were great efforts to characterize these differences between humans, because obviously this is very useful in linking traits of disease to genotype, i.e. the DNA sequence. Yes?
When you say the difference among individuals on average of every 300 nucleotides,
right,
is that really that they're sprinkled through,
yes,
the sequence? So it's not that there are particular regions that tend to correspond to individual traits or differences.
Okay, so the traits are actually grouped, so in so-called haplotypes. And certain members of populations have a specific haplotype, i.e. blocks of genetic variation which are specific for them. But these haplotypes, there are many of them, and so it's a mixture of haplotypes that really defines on what you are, where you came from, what your ancestry is. So these polymorphisms, as they're called, are highly correlated in the human genome. Okay, so there have been vast efforts to map all these polymorphisms, and nowadays of the 11 million polymorphisms that are estimated to be there, 3 million have been already identified and also genotyped, in the sense that we know which nucleotide occurs in which populations, really with which frequency at the same genomic locus. And this is a vast amount of information. We had several talks which made use of this. Okay, so in terms of RNA, so the human genome contains something like 20,000 protein encoding genes, and just in terms of assaying the expression of these genes, i.e. how many RNA molecules on the RNA level, how many RNA molecules are made from each locus, we are now talking, I looked it up yesterday, you can download from the NCBI webpage data for 140,000 experiments. So these experiments are based on microarray technology. And this technology makes use of the DNA-DNA base complementarity, i.e. so if you have two molecules of DNA which are complementary to each other, they will hybridize to form a double-stranded DNA. And this is very specific. And basically what you do in these microarrays is you have spots on a slide, and in each spot you have a specific DNA molecule, and then you pour molecules from which are expressed in the cell onto the slide, and then only the ones which, so how often they will hybridize specifically to its complementary strand in a spot will tell you the abundance of that RNA molecule in the cell. So in one go, you can measure nowadays with these microarrays the expression of 20,000 protein encoding genes at once. And what I'm saying here is that they're now already downloadable, 140,000 experiments like this under various conditions, various cells within that. So, pardon me?
Why are there more than 20,000?
Why are there more than 20,000? Well, the reason is that what is important to realize is that in each cell you have the same DNA, so you have the same potential for making any of the genes, but it's a combination of genes that is important. And it's the changes of gene expression under different conditions which is important. And so this system has a gigantic amount of, degree of freedom. And therefore, this is actually a tiny number in terms of the overall degrees of freedom. So, naively, if you just characterize the expression of a protein coding gene into high expression or no expression, and you have two states, and you have 20,000 genes, it gives a lot of combinations that are possible. So this is actually just a tiny bit, although it appears to be a large number. And yes?
This is the number of experiments, right,
more or less.
It's not the number of types of RNA. I guess the confusion was that at some point we thought that there are 140,000 types of RNA as opposed to microarray experiments. Experiment measures, you know, all the RNAs at once.
Yes, exactly.
So how many types of RNA? Could you give a ballpark of how many?
Well, so the vast majority of these have been done in human and mouse, the rest is just lagging behind. I mean, it also fly, but in first approximation, it's all human and mouse. But I'm talking here, so one experiment here is extracting one sample of RNA and putting it on a microarray. That's what makes it clear. This is somewhat diffuse. There are also time course experiments in here and so forth, but let's not go into this. So, but just to say that it's now easy to look at this information. This really you can do. But what has turned out in recent years, and this also coincidentally started in 2001, is to realize that they're not only RNAs which make proteins, but there are also many RNAs which just make RNA and nothing else. And although this was known to some extent before, it just turned out in 2001 that there's a large class of non-coding RNAs which are produced in virtually all animal and plant cells, small RNAs. And these RNAs, since they don't make any protein, you can already guess that they are acting as regulatory genes. So they can't really make a product that's important in terms of protein. So what they do is they tell other genes what kind of expression levels they should have. And it's interesting to note that now turns out that this relatively new class of RNAs regulates, for instance, in the human genome, thousands of target genes. So if you just look at a set of 60 of these guys which have been identified, there are now many more have been identified, but if you just look at 60 of them, computation estimates that they regulate close to a third of the protein encoding genes in just humans. So and it's just surprising that back 6 years ago, this was basically not there, and this is unexpected. And just you see how in biology sometimes very fundamental mechanisms pop up like this. And I'll talk a little more about this when I come to interactions, how to look at these things computationally. But I'll just leave it at the point of a discovery at this point. But I'll mention that you can also measure the abundance of these small RNAs in cells nowadays quite nicely. You can also look at their expression in an entire animal, in which cells are these molecules expressed. Then, talking about proteins, mass spec has made great advances in recent times, and there are now methods, one of them being called SILAC, where you can actually measure in just 2 hours 5,000 to 6,000 proteins, say from a human cell line, such that you can detect differences in two different conditions of the cell line, up to 30% only of individual proteins. So it allows you to look at changes in the proteome in a high throughput and quantitative way. And this kind of technology was absent also 6 years ago, and I think this is actually a great advance. I should also point out, pardon me? This is basically done by very sophisticated radioactive labeling of amino acids. And let me not go further into that. But you know, things like microarrays, mass spec, this comes very close to biophysics. And I think there are many, many interesting things to explore here from a biophysics point of view. But I would just like you to stay a little bit outside of this. Let me remark, though, that not only we are making important advances in figuring out the differences in DNA between humans, say, but also the number of sequenced genomes has in a way accumulated, which I found almost hard to believe when I compiled this yesterday. So the numbers are that in bacteria, there are now 1,200 sequenced genomes. And in eukaryotes, i.e. things which are more or less like us, not like bacteria, we have already 261 sequenced genomes, and amongst them 100 animal genomes, and amongst them 32 mammalian genomes. If you look at this, I must say, is really fantastic. You can in a massive way start to compare the DNA contents of various species over quite large but also quite fine-grained evolutionary scales. And there are various aspects of this. I mean, looking at doing cross-species comparisons, as it calls, is, I think, intuitively clear to everybody. This is hugely important because, for all we know, what has stayed constant during evolution is important. And so, the first thing you can do is you can pull out from these data sequences that are conserved and that are therefore important, likely to be important, and then you can go and test them. However, it allows you also nowadays to look at things which are specific to certain lineages. For example, you can look if you go to a phylogenetic tree of certain species, you can start to ask what is common in one lineage versus another, and what's different in one lineage versus another. So you can get at things which actually really create the diversity of life, at specific traits in lineages, and this is of course important. A completely unresolved topic is actually, where are we going to go with this? I mean, are we just going to continue to? I mean, maybe then in 5 years somebody's going to tell you, now we are 10,000 sequenced genomes. Is it actually of any importance? What do we really learn from this? How far should we go, ideally? And so this touches the question of reconstructability, right? Can you really reconstruct the DNA of an ancestor of all mammals, say? Is that possible? And to some degree, it seems to be possible. So certainly in vertebrates, it seems to be actually easier than in other parts of the animal kingdom, like in flies, where this is going to be much harder, if not impossible. So people have now already, for locus, I think, of 2 million bases or so, compiled something that they claim to be the ancestral sequence of this locus in all mammals. And God knows, of course, if that's really true or not, because how do you want to test this? But it gives you an impression that all this information is not compiled, is compiled in a way that allows at least some depth of completeness of reconstruction attempts. Okay, so I want to point out also that all this is largely technology driven, as it should be clear by now. And I think very importantly what we have learned is that in this workshop that there's a new technology which is called deep sequencing. And I believe, I'm going to make a case that this technology is going to change a lot of what I have told you up to now. And I think also that this technology is going to trigger necessarily the input of many computational people, physicists, etc. And the reason is that people have realized that sequencing can be improved. So the traditional way of sequencing, for example, how the human genome was sequenced is done by so-called Sanger sequencing, relatively old technology invented 30 years ago, something like that. But there are many other ways to sequence DNA. And again, I'm going to not really go into the biophysics of this, but just to say that even with the first iteration of alternative approaches that have been published just last year, you can improve the number of sequences that you can sequence in one go by orders of magnitude. So we are now talking about tens of millions of reads that can be sequenced in 1 hour. And each read is right now 100 to 200 nucleotides long. So you have to shear your DNA into small bits. But nevertheless, once you have done this, you can sequence 10 million guys in 1-2 hours. Okay. Now, this is only, yes? Or is that a question? So so this is, it has several implications. First of all, the read of the length is actually important, because if you want to assemble these little bits and pieces to something like the human genome, which is vastly more contiguous than that, much bigger, you're in trouble, because it's just difficult to piece together these little pieces, because they have relatively little overlap, and that's just a classic problem in assembly. However, this is just the first iteration, and the people at 444, which is one company doing this, are now, as I heard, already doing 500 nucleotides in one go. And 500 nucleotides is actually what Craig Venter had when he did his shotgun sequencing approach to the human genome, more or less. So this is going to increase, and what it will enable us is to do sequencing on a scale that is just completely unheard of. This is just going to generate an amount of data that I have a hard time to even imagine. So now you cannot only then go and okay. So I should remark that this is somewhat expensive right now. So one run is at least $10,000, but as it is with these technologies, I'm confident that the cost of this are going to decrease presumably as I don't know, the power of CPUs increases, and the cost of sequencing has also fallen for the traditional sequencing. So this is going to go down. So you're not only going to be able to sequence, if we want to, vastly more genomes like this, you can also use this to, I think, abandon microarrays also altogether. The problem with microarrays is that you have to deal with the peculiarities of the hybridization biophysics. So you always have the problem that you have your little spots on a slide with a probe, and then you're hybridizing something, And so, but what's happening for one probe is not necessarily what's happening for another probe in terms of the biophysics that's going on. And people have worked on this for a long time, but there are still problems with that, which I think are going to be hard to eliminate. It has somewhat stalled the progress in making this better. With the deep sequencing, what you can do is you can take the RNA and make DNA out of it. That's fairly standard. And then you just throw it into the sequencing machine. And then what you get is maybe for one particular gene, 1,000 times the same sequence read. And that not only tells you what's there, i.e. you have discovered something that's expressed, but you also discover the abundance of how strongly it is expressed in comparison to other things. Maybe you have, for another product, you have only found maybe 10 reads. And I think this has advantages because you're just discovering what's there in the cell. You're not doing much. You're just sequencing it. And I think it's a wonderful proxy for expression. And it comes somewhat, I'm talking about something that is just starting, and maybe I'm going to be proven wrong, but this was my impression from a number of talks and discussions I had. And I think the microarray field, there's still, like, I don't know, 10 papers at least, if not 50 published per month, just on how to analyze microarray data and to deal with all these problems. Once this will come into full swing, this entire business may go extinct. So we are talking about evolutionary processes in technology itself. And you can also do many other things with that. For example, you can find polymorphisms, i.e. variation in DNA sequences with this technology as well. And you can also, people have now also used it to map mutations. So another problem in biology is that you look for mutations that cause a certain phenotype, but then you don't know where the mutation really sits in the DNA. You have to map. This is very laborious oftentimes. And with this technology, you can also do this in a rapid and systematic fashion. So these are my comments about deep sequencing as an example where I think technology is just changing everything. Now, so much about molecules. I'm now going to talk about molecular interactions, which build networks. So one of the most basic, well, there are many molecular interactions in the cell. And here I'm just going to talk about regulatory interactions, i.e. interactions which have exert a change in the expression of other genes. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about protein-protein interactions, which are not necessarily of this type. There are, of course, many other interactions going on in the cell. But one of the most basic interactions is a protein, a certain type of protein called the transcription factor binding to DNA. And by doing so, it has the potential to modulate the rate of RNA production of a target gene, which is in the vicinity of the place where the transcription factor binds to the DNA. And this is obviously a very important interaction because it dictates the initial amount of RNA that is produced from individual genes. And we had many talks which are just about this interaction because, as you might realize, the transcription factor to do this interaction in a specific way has to recognize certain parts of the DNA. It just cannot bind to everything, otherwise it would be useless. Now, to recognize certain parts of the DNA, the transcription factor needs to recognize what's specific about this sequence, and so it comes to no surprise, perhaps, that transcription factors recognize specific DNA motifs, i.e. Something that is a specific type of small sequence of ACGTs. And so finding these interactions and characterizing them is hugely important, because this enables you to understand one very basic part of gene regulation. And putting this into the perspective of evolution, i.e. to compare how have transcription factors changed, not so much typically, but then how do the regulatory sequences have changed that mediate the interaction between the transcription factor and the DNA. This is very interesting, because it allows you, in a practical sense, to find sequences that are conserved and therefore likely to be important, but it also allows you to look at lineage-specific changes. And so there was a whole group of talks we had elucidating these interactions. From experimental point of view, this is still somewhat lagging behind in technology. However, the one advance that has been made is to use so-called chip-chip technology. So what you do there is you develop an antibody against the transcription factor, which enables you to pull out the transcription factor from the soup, so to speak, in a specific way. And by doing so, you also get the DNA, which is bound by the transcription factor. And then what you do is you take a microarray and you just throw your transcription factor with the DNA on the microarray, and then just by complementarity between the DNA and the sequences on the microarray, you can measure where this transcription factor is bound. Okay, so that's a beautiful high throughput technology, and has already given many also fundamental insights, apart from finding out regulatory interactions on a genome-wide scale. But I also want to say that once again, the deep sequencing is in my opinion, likely to change this, because with deep sequencing, you don't need the microarray anymore. You can just sequence what's there. And then once again, you don't have resolution problems. You don't have problems like cross-hybridization between similar probes and so on and so forth. And another type of interaction that we talked about, especially in the second half of the workshop, is RNA binding to RNA. So, and you see now that the what you maybe heard about information process flow in the cell dictated by the central dogma, i.e. you have DNA, which somehow processes information into RNA, and then it goes to protein. They're also very important regulatory interactions, which are happening not only in terms of transcription, but also in terms of just RNA interacting with RNA. And so I was alluding to this in the beginning. Small RNAs, which are encoded by the genome, bind to messenger RNAs from other genes. Small RNAs. And this interaction happens by sequence complementarity once again. So if you have a small RNA, so some maybe 20 nucleotides long molecule, this will go and bind to target messenger RNAs, which are which can be any sort, but in one messenger RNA, which is typically for protein encoding genes much longer, easily thousands of nucleotides, the small RNA will recognize a certain target. Again, we're talking about specificity of gene regulation, by recognizing a certain fragment of this mRNA that has a sequence that is complementary to the small RNA. And so we had several talks which were elucidating the nature of this interaction, how you can use the computer to predict these interactions, and how you can also study evolution. It's actually an elegant system for this, I believe, because you can guess the targets of the regulatory factor just by sequence analysis, right? If you have a transcription factor, this is some protein which is going to have, which is going to recognize some motif, but it's impossible to just by sequence, by knowing the sequence of the transcription factor, to guess what the transcription factor is going to bind to. So here you have a situation where you have a large class of regulators which regulate lots of target genes, and you can study what these target genes are and the evolution of the interactions from a purely sequence level, and we had a number of talks which were related to this topic. Altogether, I mean, to summarize these two basic interactions or transcription, pardon me?
Small RNA are made, reverse synthesis?
Small RNAs are made just like any other regular gene. They just, there's a small piece of the genome, yeah, just transcribed from the DNA. No, so this is an mRNA from some completely different gene. And what's happening here is that this small RNA is telling this other gene how to be expressed. Okay, and it's doing it by recognizing a sequence here by binding, and then there's some
small gene has to be the complement of the
yes,
RNA.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, okay, so these regulatory interactions I told you about sequences that are recognized in the DNA, specifically by the transcription factor, and sequences that are recognized in mRNAs by small RNAs. These sequences, these regulatory sequences, reside in the non-coding parts of the genome, i.e. parts which do not code for protein, but they harbor the potential to tell the protein-coding genes to what levels they should be expressed. And so to decipher this regulatory potential of the genome is overall one of the main topics nowadays in genomics, functional genomics, systems biology, you name it. But just to try to understand this is a common theme. Now, let's come to networks.
So these are the only two?
No, there are many, many more. And since regulation of gene expression is very important to the cell, cells have evolved an arsenal of methods how to control how much of a product is being made, when, where, and how. But these are two of the main ones. Now, talking about networks, so here we have just an interaction between one gene and one other. Now, from these, you can imagine that they form, that regulatory networks are being formed, because if one gene tells another one what to do, then this gene in turn will tell other genes, can tell other genes what to do. So through these interactions, you get networks of interacting molecules. And I think it is fair to say that nowadays most people believe that actually to describe what's going on in a cell at a given time, you have to think about networks. Okay, it's just not a single gene that will tell you what's really going on. It's about how genes are wired together in a certain moment of time and space in an organism. Now, how much do we know about these networks? So there have been some model systems where this has been dissected, one in fly, Drosophila, where a lot is known about how the fly embryo develops its body patterning, so how really the head, the thoracic parts are formed. And this comprises, I would say, maybe 30 key transcription factors, which are important in the early stages of this development. Hundreds, if not thousands, of target genes which are regulated, which are sitting together with these key transcription factors in the network. And there's a vast literature about this. So I can tell you that there are certainly 500 papers which have been produced by molecular biology just about this system, and I'm presumably not counting many. But what has happened is that the genome-wide approaches have changed the way of doing this. So computation, for example, has enabled people in a more informed way to study candidate genes that might be sitting in the network and that might be sitting in a way wired to the network that was predicted. And it turns out that in many cases, these computational approaches are powerful because it makes life simple for, more simple for the experimental authors to get at these networks, because they only have to skim a list of candidates rather than dissecting networks on a genome-wide level, which is still a very challenging phase. And then there have been also general, I think, insights into how networks are organized. And I'll come to this a little more in detail when I finish by making my comments about evolution. Another system which where we had three beautiful lectures was sea urchin. Eric Davidson talked about this, and this is again about early development of sea urchin. And so the way they constructed a map of the network in sea urchin, so the network that produces the various body parts, was by first identifying which transcription factors were expressed in the early embryo, and then experimentally dissecting their interactions. Okay, and this has produced now a map which Eric believes is more or less complete of how the early body parts are formed. Then other types of networks are protein interaction networks. So what has happened here is that a technology was developed which allows you to find out which proteins make contact to each other in the cell. And this can be done on a more or less genome-wide level. And this technology was emerged actually years ago. And Sergey, maybe you can tell me when exactly, I forget, maybe.
It was did it in early 1993.
93,
okay. Yeast to hybrid, yeah.
So, yeah, so the technology is called the yeast to hybrid. And there was vast criticism, I can tell you, in the early days of this, until recently actually, so it was pointed out that there were many false positives, so interactions that were published but not true, and many missing interactions which are not detected by the assay. But what people now, I think, agree on is that the technology has been improved so vastly that in principle one should redo all the experiments again with the improved technology, and then one can actually, one should have a decent data set. Now, what have we learned from these protein-protein interactions? So certainly it's a good way to find out interaction partners of the gene. If you see that it's actually bound to some other product, it's likely, or there's a good chance that it has actually a function, although this is not clear at all, because you can also have all kinds of unspecific interactions without function. But have we learned something from the from looking at the network topology, for instance, right? So how many are then, we look at a gene which is connected to many others, and then there's maybe another gene which is connected only to a few. If you look at the general topology of this, can you make statements which are meaningful? And I think the consensus of various talks was that not only in this type of situation, but also when you look at other types of networks on this kind of global topology level, insights have to be taken with a lot of care, big grain of salt, because one of the inherent problems is that to do all this, you have to always come up with a comparison, right? You have to say, if something appears to be in this topology peculiar, well, peculiar compared to what? And these types of comparisons are non-trivial, because we're looking at a highly evolved system. So what do you really compare with? And I think, at least personally, I think that some of the claims that have been made, for example, about network motifs, have to be discussed critically. So what are network motifs? This was the attempt to look at, say, interactions between three genes or four genes, and to see if they're wired together in a way which is special compared to some comparison network. Okay, and then you can say that it appears that under this special comparison, certain types of network motifs are much more prominent than you would expect. And then you can look at them and come up with reasons why that should be. And I think, I mean, undoubtedly it's important to think about network motifs, because they form interesting units that have a certain signature of information processing. But I think the claim to just from this type of statistics to conclude anything about important or less importance of certain types of motifs is difficult. So let me, in the remaining past 5 minutes, which is a little bit crazy, talk about evolution. And what I want to do is to sketch out the big animal tree. So we have the deuterostomes and we have the protostomes. This is no good. Here we have the ecdysozoans. And we have the so-called lophotrochozoans. I love this word, lophotrochozoans. And we have, say, here the chordates, which we all know because we are part of them, and other things. Now, all this last common ancestor originated something like 600 million years ago. Okay, so these words presumably mean nothing to you. And I wrote them down to make clear that they come from a thinking where developmental biologists looked at many different ways how animals develop in their early stages and then tried to come up with signatures which I thought were kind of, well, global or very important for them. And then they would group these animals based if they had the signature or not. For example, this signature comes from a German biologist in the early 20th century, who for some reason decided that it's important to see if at a certain early event the mouth is formed first or the anus is formed first. And so it turned out that this guy had a lot of intuition in this case, because if you now do modern phylogeny, i.e. you look in terms of, with other methods at trying to genomic sequence essentially to come up with a phylogeny, it turned out that this is true. So it seems at least that members of this family are more close to each other than to any of these ones, and vice versa. Yeah. Well, I forget which method. Maybe. Okay. Similar ecdysozoans and lophotrochozoans. I don't really know what lophotrochozoans are, but Eric Davidson also says that this is likely to split up or go away. Ecdysozoans are things which mold. So here you have, and other things, but here you have, for example, fly, and here you have C. elegans. And for the ones of you which are really hardcore physicists, these two model systems are the most prominent model system outside of the chordates. Okay? So a vast amount of money and time has gone into studying these two, and of course it has yielded many, many, many important insights. Nobel Prizes have been given to this, for example. But lophotrochozoans, there's simply no model organism. We know basically nothing about this part of life. And I just want to mark in passing that therefore I'm interested in Planaria, which are a certain type of flatworms which have interesting regeneration capabilities. You can cut them up into 300 pieces, the animals maybe a centimeter long, and each piece will develop into the entire animal without any help from the outside. So, okay. Now, I want to go a bit further. I think looking now at evolution, i.e. trying to understand animals, how they look like, what they share, what's different between them, will require looking at the evolution of networks, because as I was pointing out, networks are really what define the cell. And to understand the differences between cells, you have to look at the evolution of networks. And I think this is also just starting. Some concepts have emerged, for example, One concept is that of a kernel, or also in another spelling. So this was put forward by Garcia Bellido in the 80s. This is put forward by Eric Davidson more recently. But this is the idea that you have a group of genes which have regulatory interactions such that if you break one of the regulatory interactions, the function of this group of genes is broken. Okay? By definition, since you cannot break them, they stay constant in evolution, right? So here you have something that is absolutely non-robust, and yet you can find, at least in some cases, through vast distances in animal evolution. So on this type of network interaction, there seems to be a very high pressure. Okay? On other parts of networks, we had many examples where you see that things are more loose. So it seems that networks can change much more easily. And the question is, how easily are these changes gradual? Can we even talk about gradual changes? Because if you think about it, these types of groups which are highly connected, they also immediately suggest that a lot in developmental evolution is actually non-gradual changes, but things where one group of genes flips from one way of talking to the network to another one, but you cannot break sort of the components comprised of several genes. So there has been the proposal that there's less of a gradual evolution than maybe people thought, as suggested by Darwin. But I want to end by saying that in work by Fabio Piano from New York University, he did the following experiment. He constructed a phylogeny of C. elegans species. Okay, there are many C. elegans species. He constructed a phylogeny for them. And then he looked in 15 of these different species, all related to each other, but all sitting in a tree. He looked at very basic characteristics of early development. Okay, so like 15 characteristics for these different species. And he simply asked which character is present in which one. So it's present, it's absent, it's like this, it's like that. For example, you have the chromosome segregating vertically or from left to right in another branch, and you can go on like this. Now, you would think that this should be somehow at least overall consistent with the phylogeny, right? After all, the idea of phylogeny is that if two things are similar, they're likely to share a common ancestor. Right? That's the basic idea. So if you now look at very basic processes distributed over some tree, you should be able to see that they're consistent, that they coincide in the logic of appearance with the phylogenetic tree. What he found is that for these things, there was nothing. Basically, it seemed more or less completely uncorrelated, and I don't know really what to make of this. Maybe it's the fact that the phylogeny was done by looking at the ribosomal RNA, which is just something that changes very slowly, and it's a standard technique by which you compare these sequences between the different species, and then you just build on sequence similarity, what's most similar to each other, and then you go and build a tree. So is there a big mystery, or is there some more trivial explanation? C. elegans is known for the fact that species can look very similar to each other, but yet have a very dramatic difference in their genetic material. For example, one worm, which is called C. elegans, and another one is called C. briggsi, they look really, it's hard for somebody who has worked for 20 years on C. elegans to come up with any difference under the microscope between C. elegans and C. briggsi. They just look extremely similar. However, in their DNA sequence, they're comparable to human and chicken. Okay. So maybe it's the problem of this, but I think whatever the problem may be, I think it might be very interesting to look at networks from the point of view to find out what kind of properties of networks are actually consistent with the phylogeny and which parts are not. And I think this might be an interesting avenue to think about networks, but much more is to come, and I'm finished. And I want to thank also, I forgot this actually, I have it on my notes. Also want to thank all the participants of the workshop for being patient. And that's it for me.
Complexities of the network in terms of the possible outcomes, that there had to be something like small RNAs prior to their discovery?
I doubt that anybody would have, based on the
I understand, two components, or three different things acting, there's only so many possible outcomes. I'm just wondering whether there was already evidence of the possible numbers of actions.
No. I think it's characteristic of these things.
That's a state of the understanding.
Yeah.
What you described is the small RNA is acting sort of a translation factor. Can it also act as a transcription factor? Is there any possibility for it?
Okay, so in certain eukaryotic systems, this is happening. So the small RNAs can go in the glucose, bind to DNA, and recruit factors to trigger so-called chromatin structure differences on the DNA level. So this can lead to silencing of other genes that does so. And to what extent this is true for, say, humans is a matter of hard debate. And I can't tell you the answer right now, but they have the potential to do that.
Before the 600 million years, there was another 3 billion years.
I guess we had stormy discussions about this, some more rigorous than others. There was a long time where there simply was no multicellular life, right? So it was all bacteria or archaea. Unicellular organisms, and then there was one, probably might call it Big Bang, where suddenly it seems non-cellular life arose. But for the most, if you look at the overall scale, for the most part, life was unicellular.
Yes, but there was also development, I presume.
Well, so for unicellular organisms, it's harder to talk about development because development. This is what you mean. Development really is how a multicellular system is produced from one cell.
Evolution.
Oh, you mean evolution? Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, so there was certainly evolution happening. When you look at the 1,200 bacteria, you realize that there's a big part of the community working on the evolution of unicellular organisms, which has completely skipped this here. But this is of course happening. One of the interesting things is that there are two types of unicellular organisms, the archaea and the typically mean by bacteria, so two different parts, and they seem to have a very, very ancient common ancestor that evolved. So they have been developing for a long time in independent fashion.
But are there no networks inside the cell itself?
Oh, yeah, certainly. So, say, like E. coli, the best studied bacteria, I think it's fair to say, that there are vast networks known. For example, the metabolic network, which are about how the bacteria eats and consumes, produces energy, so forth. And they have the Met election, and I'm not saying knowledge and style and details, but we would hang out a poster of all the interactions that are known or pathways that are known in the car. It would easily fill half of the blackboard in the very fine print.
But I guess when you described the regulatory network, you concentrated only on the part of regulatory networks which are involved in development of multicellular organisms. But both bacteria and single-cell eukaryotes and multicell eukaryotes also have a vast regulatory network which regulate just the kind of day-to-day activity of the cell. So that's how I understood your question, right? You were asking whether there were regulation involved in bacteria as well. So the answer is yes, and it's similar to what happens in eukaryotes. A little bit more more plain, but still very sophisticated.
You emphasize the development of the technology and how our ability to do these things is getting much more powerful. And I was wondering what's driving that. Is that the idea that people would like to have their own genome done for $100, or is it that the biological research is somehow seen to be the correct motive for this?
So, I could immediately answer by listing some biologically very reasonable things that can be done, will be done with this technology. For example, sequence cancer patients. And that is being done actually now. Now 100 cancer patients are at least partially resequenced, and there will be much more. And something is going to come out of this. I mean, I don't know what, but it's pretty confident that something will come out of this. This is not how this technology operates. It just needs something, not the information in there. But I'm sure that there are also people who would just like to see it because they would like to have their own genome sequence and find out if they can go into some risks and diseases. Although all the research is close. There's several things you can already get tested for. You may be lagging in view of the cost right now for doing this. But in the long run, I personally think yes, this will happen. And I also think that specialized diagnosis and therapy and all these things that will come and is all connected to the kind of technology. In this case, I think revolution is going to make this possible. Hopefully,
in a way that everybody can profit from it, not only people with lots of color. Another question? Well, I'm just wondering, I was surprised by one in 300 individual difference. Could you just put another number on that, like chimpanzee? I mean, across species, a close species as opposed to two individuals in a species?
There have been people running around for a long time who say that humans and chimps are something 98 point something similar. The number means very little to me because it depends really on what kind of variation you have. So chimps have, polymorphisms, the number of polymorphisms I think is not maybe that meaningful, the number of differences we what would be the absolute number. But it's different in different populations because it just so happens that these kinds of things depend on the population size and they also depend on demography. So for example, if a population went under a bottleneck, right? So humans underwent a bottleneck at some point in time, a very small population. And that means that almost all polymorphisms that we see nowadays go back to this one founder population. But in other organisms, you can have many, many more polymorphisms. I mean, zebrafish, we're discussing this, you have actually so many polymorphisms that you have a problem sequencing the genome because you have to know which allele to sequence from each locus. And you can run into huge problems with assembling the genome because the alleles are so different that you get confused.
by then. Are you just looking at functional DNA for those distinctions, or are you, as opposed to junk DNA in where holes plug up was
You don't know. I mean, there might be many functional differences in these different diseases, or it's important in.
I was asking specific things like the 1 in 300 number that you're giving. Are those looking at actual out of functional areas? Are a lot of the variation?
I don't know how many of the variation is functional. There have been certainly a whole number of known cases where these variations are linked to disease or other functional readout. But I cannot give an estimate of how much of that is. I simply cannot. Okay, so everybody's alive? Thank you very much. Thank you.